History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we know they don't have to go untold if we take action before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always end up educated. We're entertained, of course. And almost without fail, we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend, we get to celebrate America's 250th birthday with flags and fireworks and hopefully heaps of gratitude. Back in 1776, it was the courage of people willing to pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor that set us on a course that would establish the United States as a beacon of freedom and liberty around the world. But keeping that torch burning has exacted a heavy cost over those years, and we've been hearing glimpses of that from our veterans for the last couple decades. Today, we'll hear the memories of three different World War II veterans from three very different backgrounds, but the common thread throughout, their perspective on the price of freedom is sure to resonate. We'll start with Ruben Ramirez, who served in Europe with the Blue Devils of the 88th Infantry Division. He grew up being called Little Hank because he was so inseparable from his only brother, Hank. When Hank was killed in action in the Philippines during the war, Reuben was actually in the hospital in Europe. It was one of three times he would be wounded during World War II.
I got wounded and they shipped me back to the hospital, pulled some fragment out of my ankle.
How'd you get hit? Where were you? What happened?
We were fighting out in the open and I don't know how I got hit because I didn't feel anything. There was excitement of the fighting. I didn't know it was hit until I started feeling my shoe like wet inside, and I looked down and I seen blood coming out of my boot. And I called for a medic. They patched me up, sent me back to the back to the aid station. From there, they sent me to the hospital. But I didn't know I was hit until I felt some pain and felt my shoe all soggy. It had been raining, so I figured it was bad because of the water. But when I checked it out, my socks was all red with blood. And got me back to the aid station.
Did that get your attention at all? Did that make you feel a little more susceptible or vulnerable?
Definitely, because artillery has no conscience. It can hit way over here. You can be over here and a little further away from where it hits, but a shell breaks up into so many little pieces, big pieces and little pieces, that anyone can hit you. That's what hit me on my ankle, a piece of shrapnel.
So you're in the hospital recuperating, trying to get better so you can go help your buddies some more, and you get word from home that your brother has been killed in this same war.
Yeah, that was notifying me that he had been killed.
That had to be devastating for you. I can't imagine what that felt like.
It was very devastating. Yeah. Well, the staff was real good. You know, they understood. So they kind of left me alone in my sorrow. But they were all understanding. And it took care of me, you know, to my benefit.
And I know you had plenty of motivation already. I mean, you had a clear purpose you were fighting for. The world was at stake here. But I imagine that made it more personal for you. Did that give you more motivation to win this war and also more motivation to make it home to your family?
I'm motivated to be safer, to keep them out of danger as much as possible, but it's impossible to say, well, I'm not going to go out there because I know they're going to be shooting there. You had to do it. You had to continue the war as it was as a fighting soldier. You had to go out and do it again. There was ups and downs in there.
And I imagine it had to be hard to be so far from home knowing what your family must be going through back home.
That was very true. But your thoughts are there. And the letter would take, I don't know how many weeks to go home between the connection, you know, communication. Even with the V-mail, it was a little faster, but it was still took a long time to get back and forth with letters.
So you heal up, and you go back to your outfit, back on the BAR?
Yep, still go back. They saved it for me. Two different people were assigned to me because the other ones had been wounded, too, earlier. So we separated, and they never came back to the squad. So when I went back, they put me in my same position as a BAR team leader with two new men that I have to, you know, get reacquainted and trained and to see what kind of action that they would be giving or what kind of backup they could give you. Because you have to know, depend on your teammates.
And I mentioned that that was only the first of three times that you were wounded during the war. What was the second?
Again, shrapnel. We're in a firefight and the Germans were in front of us. And there was a valley to the back of us, and we were in the hillside looking down in the valley, but the fighting was in a town which was in front of us. We were in the crest of the road, of the hill, and their shell was hitting down there in the valley because our troops were moving up on that side. And I was in a hole upstairs looking toward the town where the enemies were. And my friend, my mates there, jumped out of the hole hollering that he was wounded, jumped out of the hole, and I seen that a hole about the size of a fist, out of his cap was gone, you know, from where the shells hit, where a shrapnel hit him. And he got out of the hole. I pulled him back down, hollered at the sergeant. The sergeant said, well, the aid men are busy, so get him and take him back to the aid station, which is about 150 yards in a farmhouse to the other side. So I got him and calmed him down and got him in a fireman's carry and started down and away from the crest of the hill so that the enemy won't see me. Until I got into an open field, and then we were running across the open field when I felt a pain in my hand and in my thigh, and I fell down. And I told the guy, I'm dropping the packs here because we were all loaded down with packs. So it says, so, and then we'll make it the rest of the way. But in that time, there was sniper fire coming at us. So he said, we got to get up and get out of here. So we finally got him into the aid station, and they took care of him right away, and then they asked me if I wanted some dry socks to take back to the guys. I said, yeah. I said, yeah, because my shoes are all wet and full of water. And again, I took off my boot, and the blood had run down my leg. And I said, okay, let's take a look at you. So the aid man looked at me and said, no, you're not going back out. I lost my pack. I lost my souvenir pistols. I lost everything that I had in the pack, a personal being, you know, things.
You had left that in the field just trying to make it there, right?
Yeah, so somebody else picked them up and got the pistols, and I hope they shared whatever it was they wanted. Because, you know, it's all personal stuff that you pick up along the way and you keep for little souvenirs. But I had taken a .32 caliber Walther off of a German officer earlier when we were walking up the road, and there was a farmhouse. The lieutenant tells me, take your team, go and check out that farmhouse. They're walking in the road. So when we get over there, we start hollering, if they're in there, to come out in English, you know, and in German, comes to see here, you know, try to make some kind of communication. So two soldiers came out with their hands up, and we took them aside, and then we start saying, anybody else in there? And then this officer walks out with his hands up, and two other soldiers come out with him. So there was five people in there, and there was only three of us. But when he approached me, I told him, you know, in front of me, we started searching down. I got the pistol off of him, and I lost that. That was a personal thought to having that.
The thing that strikes me, and I know you're not patting yourself on the back, you're just telling me what happened, but so often we hear these kind of stories, and when you're in that situation, you do what you hope the other guy would do for you. But I'm struck by a verse in the Bible. It says, greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friend. And you almost lost your life trying to save someone else's.
Well, it happens like that, but you don't give that a thought, though. You do what you have to do, especially somebody wounded like that, because he was really hurting and he was bleeding good, and I just had to get him over there. There was no other thought of doing nothing else but getting him there.
And for those of us who haven't been in a war, haven't been in a combat situation, we can't understand it the way you do, but I'm curious, did that anger you? Because obviously you're upset that you got shot. But when you thought about the fact that you're not a threat at this point, you're just trying to carry a wounded soldier to an aid station and someone shot you in that process, did that anger you? Did that seem out of line even in a war situation?
No, I didn't give it a thought to it. I'm a soldier. I'm an enemy. I can become his victim. If he can shoot good, he's going to get us. If not, well, my thought was just getting him, my friend, to the aid station. And no thought of the consequences in between, because you do what you have to do. Like I say, your stamina is going, your adrenaline your thoughts are just to accomplish one thing, and that was to get him from point A to point B. Consequences in between is something else that are not predictable.
So you've told us about two times being hit by shrapnel, and neither time did you really realize what had happened to you. What about the third? What were the circumstances there?
Oh, it was a shrapnel from a mortar. We were online on advancing, but we stopped at a farmhouse. Some of the guys went into the farmhouse. Some of the guys went to the barn to get some rest, cook up things, clean up, or just relax or something. And I told my sergeant, well, I'm going to go over to the house to see some of the guys. So I was walking across the barnyard when three shells, mortar shells, came in there. And I was in the middle of it. So all I did was take off and just run to the house and got in there. And then I told the guy again, you better check me out because I feel some blood running down my leg. He looked and said, well, I can't tell if there's any metal in there or not, but you're bleeding pretty good. You're going back to the hospital for x-rays to make sure. Patched me up, put me in an ambulance back to the hospital, took x-rays, kept me for a couple of days, sent me back because they didn't find no metal in there. You know, they just sewed it up and sent me back in a few days. I got a few days rest out of it anyway.
It makes me wonder what all that did to your outlook, because here you are, your brother's been killed in this war. You've been wounded three times. Moving on from there, were you scared that the next time was going to be worse, or did you feel like, you know what, nothing's going to happen to me if I can take care of all of this?
If you say that you're not scared, you're crazy, because you have to be scared no matter what. You anticipate, if it's going to be combat, you know, you start the fighting, you have to anticipate if one is going to hit me now or later or what's going to happen. But to say that you're not scared is just a poor saying that you're, no one realizes what you're in. I say I was scared, and everybody tells you that they weren't scared in combat. I'm not going to say they were liars, but...
Over the years, as you've gone to reunions and talked to other guys from your division and you've read about it, what do you appreciate most about what you, in conjunction with all these other guys, were able to accomplish?
Well, we did fight one of the tougher divisions of the German Army, and they gave us a lot of credit for being such good fighters as far as that goes. Overall for the division.
And that's where your nickname came from, right?
Right. The ferocity of the fighting that they first went into surprised Axis Sally, who was a propaganda broadcaster. Those blue devils with those patches were too ferocious to fight, you know. They hated to come against the division.
Those blue clover leaf patches on your shoulders is what she was referring to. And obviously, if the division adopted that as the new nickname, I guess you guys took some pride in that description, huh?
Everybody was proud to be able to, here comes a blue devil. Yeah, I got a jacket with it says that and everything. And I was at this AMVET convention this past month, and I wore it over there. And they looked at it and said, what's that blue devil do you have there? And then I turned my back and I have them read the back because it says 88 Division Association, and it has the patch. It says that's what it represents.
And from what I've heard from other veterans from that division over the years is that it was pretty nonstop action, right? I mean, you guys saw a lot of days of combat. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. You know, we fought three different combat zones. The first one was Romarno, and then we fought the Po Valley, and then we fought the Apennines battle. So that's three different combat zones. And they were all lasted maybe 2, 3, 4 months in between, on and off, on and off. You went in reserve to rest and take care of it, and then you go back on the line, and somebody else would come off the line to rest up.
Well, I want to get to the Apennines and some of the things I've heard about that, but when you talk about those three times you were wounded and the time that that took you off the front lines, have you ever thought about that, that maybe... As painful as it was and as scary as it was, you were actually fortunate to be wounded when you were? Did it take you away from stuff that could have been worse?
When I got back, a lot of the guys were gone. They were either killed or wounded. And you go back to your squad, there are all new faces there. And you have to get familiarize yourself with them and to know them and see what they are and how they think and everything. So you go back, your whole squad might be gone. When you're just assigned to a squad. Like one time that I came back to the company, I was supposed to report to my company, the E company. Instead, the guys come and said, you're going to G company. I said, no, I don't want to go to G company. They need replacements. They need them now. We can't stand and argue that you're not going to go because that's where you're going. So they picked five guys that were returning to send them to G Company. So they go over there, report in and everything else. And next day, we're new people in their company. We don't know them. They don't know us. They put us on a patrol to go out on a patrol. Okay. The lieutenant points to me and says, you're Lee Scout. Okay, fine. Get me a Tommy gun, because if I were Lee Scout in my company, they'd give me a Tommy gun. He said, well, we don't have Tommy guns for you. You have to use your rifle. So I said, I can't be a scout with a rifle. So we discussed it back and forth. I wasn't to argue. We discussed it back and forth. And I seen a corporal with a Tommy gun. And I said, he's got a Tommy gun. He's not using it. I can carry it out there and bring it. If I make lucky, I'll bring it back to him. So he goes and gets the Tommy gun. He gives it to me and says, you're Lee Scout now. I said, okay. So we take off and over through the hills and the road. We go through a town. And there's a bluff on this side. Then there's a road. And then there's a valley. And as I come out of the town and down the road, make a curve, there's a hut on the side of the road over here. And I see Germans going into it. So I flop at the ditch right there at the bottom, next to the bluff that's there. There's a little ditch. And sign for tell the guys to stop back there and everything. Lieutenant comes up and I tell him what I saw. And he says, well, hold attention here. Don't fire or anything. Just watch. And then he said, I'm going to take part of the guys around through the valley and go around it before we do anything. If you hear firing, then you start firing. So as they're going advancing down there, a German gun is up on a hillside, already sighted at him. They started firing at them. I waited to see if he was going to holler or anything, but he didn't. And I said, well, if they're firing down there, it says there's Germans in the hills. So I started backing up and telling the guys to run back. So we go running back the road into town, and we're going down the road, and this machine gun starts firing right down the center of the road. If he were to move it 1 inch to either side, he could have got everyone, but it went right down the middle of the road. Then we got to a wall. We flop in behind the wall, and we waited. It stopped firing. We make a dash across the road, and we got it up behind the wall. And the lieutenant turns around and says, you go back and check that guy that's laying over there. I said, what guy? I thought I was the last one. He said, well, there's a man down over there by the wall. So go and check to see if he's wounded or what's his condition. So he gives me about 5 little vials of morphine in case he's wounded. So I dash across the road. Nobody fired. I checked him out. He was dead. So I got ready and then dashed back across the road again to the east side. And then we went to town and set up a defense position for a counterattack in case. But we waited about an hour and they didn't do anything. So we started backing out. It was getting dusk. So we returned to our lines. But, of course, you're a new man in a company like that. That's what happens. You have to be the first one to be exposed. But 2 days later, I get back to my own company.
That must have been a sigh of relief just for the comfort level you had with them, huh?
Yeah, because I got to see my friends, you know. Because they got more new replacements come in, so they were assigned over there. And we got them sent back to our company, which was a relief for us. We got to rest for a couple of weeks before we were in reserve.
Tell me about the Apennines campaign. What was the fighting like? What were the conditions like? Because I've heard some pretty awful stories about the weather conditions, the terrain, the enemy. How did you experience that?
Once you got out of the Po Valley and into the mountains, you're fighting rain, you're in fog, you're in total black darkness. You don't know where they're at. They know where you're at. They're up higher and they can see where we're progressing along the roads, because you have to stick to the roads, and there are very places that you can get away from track climbing a mountain. But the worst experience was being up in the mountains and you're on guard duty at midnight. Pitch black, you can't see your hand in front of your eyes, like in front of your face, and it's foggy. You hear the water dripping off of the leaves, making noises. Your senses become acute to hear what kind of noise are you hearing. You can't see anything, but you hear a particular dripping on this side or rustling or on that side. I mean, I was scared of the dark. I have to sleep with a nightlight. I have to sleep with light.
Today you do because of an experience years ago.
I can't sleep without it. If I fall asleep when it's dark, when I wake up, I get a panic attack. The worst part is I make sure the lights are on.
That's something you've just had to live with ever since the war?
Yeah. I sleep with the lights on outside. I sleep with the night lights inside. It's something you can't say, turn it off. You can't turn it off.
So many of us today go along with our lives and we don't realize what people like you went through. And when you think about your brother and you think about your own life and the things you've had to deal with, do you ever think about your brother and who he would have been, what he would have done in his life, what kind of difference he would have made?
I do think about that. I've thought that a lot. He was a good leader. We always had a bunch of friends around with him. That's where that little Hank and Big Hank nickname came out, because he had a lot of friends.
Hank Ramirez was one of over 400,000 Americans who paid the ultimate price in World War II. Younger brother Reuben came oh so close to joining him. It's time for our first break, but when this special Independence Day episode continues, a man whose life was saved in one of World War II's most famous rescues. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Independence Day edition on this 250th birthday celebration weekend for America. Those among us who have seen their freedom flash before their eyes, those who faced the prospect of being killed or captured in battle, well, they appreciate that freedom even more. And of all the daring rescues in World War II, it is hard to find one that tugs at the heartstrings more than the rescue of the Lost Battalion. Thought of as the greatest collective achievement of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, a segregated unit made up of Americans of Japanese ancestry who suffered over 800 casualties in liberating 211 surrounded soldiers of the 141st Infantry Regiment. One of those men whose life was spared there in the Vosges Mountains was Al Tortolano.
The Germans are on another hill looking right down our throats, and we started getting mortar fire. There were six of us walking in a line, and a mortar hit right close by, and the guy behind me, two guys away from me, one of them got killed. The lead man got killed. I must have been blown up off about 3 or 4 feet off the ground, so I became one of the guys that had to be carried off the hill. And I don't know how I made it, because when I got to the aid station where they took care of us, when they showed me the blanket that I had under my arm that we were going to use to cover the wounded with, they opened it up. It was loaded full of holes with shrapnel. So I got shrapnel there. I had some shrapnel here and a couple of pieces in my throat.
So in your midsection and your throat, all over the place, and you had to be in pain and wondering if you're going to make it.
Well, I didn't know. They say I was out for 3 days. So I really didn't know anything until I came to on the third day. But they said everything was okay, except for the concussion and stuff. They said I was all right. So they kept me another day. I think I was there altogether 5 days. Then they said that I was well enough to go back to my outfit.
But from the moment that shell hit to you coming to in the aid station, 3 days worth of life, you don't remember anything between that time.
Nope, I don't know what happened while I was there.
And they said you were fine to go back to the Lions. Did you feel like you were ready to go back to the Lions?
No, but I knew I had to go back. And the funny part, well, they were going to put me in the nearest outfit. And I said, no way. I said, I'm going, I want to go back to my own outfit. Because even though we kept losing men, there were still, you know, guys that I knew. And I didn't want to go in with a group of strangers. So I found my own way back to where the 36th Division was.
And I'm sure eventually you wondered if that was the right thing to do once the whole Lost Battalion incident unfolded. Tell me about that. For those who aren't familiar with it, where were you guys, and how did you become, as they say now, lost and abandoned?
Okay, that was in the Bosage Mountains up around Bruyères. Mm-hmm. And our objective was up in to take this hill and capture this hill, because it would be a strategic hill to look down on the Germans on the other side. Now, it was tough going to get there because there was no road, no nothing up there, and we had to more or less go up like in a column of ones. Going up, it seemed it wasn't bad. We had hardly any resistance, and we thought, wow, this is a piece of cake. You know, and we got up there, and we practically had hardly any fighting at all. But then, all of a sudden, the next morning, we're wondering, well, how come there's nobody coming up? Come to find out, Germans let us get up there, and then they cut right down in back of us and cut us off. And I don't think we didn't know it for at least almost a day and a half that we were cut off. We didn't know what the heck we were going to do. So they sent out I think it was about a 25-man patrol. And then we didn't find out till later that they didn't get through, and we don't know what happened to them, whether they captured, killed, or what, but they didn't get through. We couldn't figure out what the heck we were going to do. We had a radio man, this Irwin Blonder. He radioed, used the radio to tell him that, hey, we're in dire need of food, ammunition, and stuff like that, because we were, like I said, we were cut off. They couldn't get anybody to us. They couldn't get anything to us. It got to the point where we pooled our resources. On the third day, whatever we had, little food we had, we pooled it, pooled the ammunition, and we were allotted so much stuff a day, you know.
So were you personally aware of how dire this situation was, and that at that point it was most likely you were either going to be killed or captured?
Yeah. On the fourth day, we knew for sure that, like I said, this Irwin Blonder, he got word that they had tried, 2nd Battalion had tried getting us out. They couldn't do it. And the American, whatever American troops they sent in, they got beat back. They just couldn't break through. And so it got to the point that I think it was on the fifth day when Irwin Blonder and his Captain Martin, I think his name was, he was in charge. From what I found out from Blonder after, it was almost like flipping a coin. So do we give up, or do we, you know, stay and try to fight it out? And their decision was we're gonna fight it and see, you know, what happens. As things turned out, on the seventh day, they got the 442nd to come in, and they lost a lot of men to get. We were about 220 of us, and they lost, oh, I don't know how many men wounded and captured and stuff to get through to us. But they finally got through to us on the seventh day.
You talk about the captain deciding whether or not to surrender. Have you ever wondered how your life would have been different if they had surrendered? And you think you'd still be here if they had surrendered and you guys would have become prisoners of war?
No, I don't know if the rumors were true or not, but from what we gathered, you didn't want to be a prisoner. You know, how are you going to be treated? And if you got to the point where we lost the war, what would happen to us, you know, as prisoners of Germany? You know, it was just something that, you know, and after we even talked about it, says, hey, if it was like a thing where, okay, let's take a vote, I think that most of us were going to vote to fight, you know, fight or be captured or killed or whatever. But I think giving up was never an option.
Before I ask you about the 442nd and how indebted you feel to those guys, just tell me what it was like when you realized that someone had broken through, that you guys had a chance of being rescued. What were those moments like, and what kind of feeling was that for you?
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it? You know, knowing that I'm never gonna come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had. But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know, because you figure it was 7 days of what we went through. And it was really hell up there, because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain, you know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you had to worry about tree bursts, you know. When all of a sudden we heard one guy say, oh my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. And yet they were attached to our division at times. But we didn't even know, and that's why that's one guy that made that remark when we saw Japanese soldiers who were fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we want to do was get our butts off that mountain, and off we went.
And I'm sure it wasn't until later that you realized the severe losses that they absorbed. They lost more men than they saved in terms of rescuing you. When you figured that out, how did that weigh on you? How did you process that, knowing that many men had sacrificed their lives for yours?
When I finally got to the, you know, thinking, really thinking about it, I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful. And then when we found out years, we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it. I felt so bad. I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war. I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. Then I find out what their parents went through, and for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did, I don't know, I didn't know how to think about it. It's something you figure, man, I just grab them and want to hug them, you know, and show them how you really felt about them.
And for folks who aren't familiar with the 442nd, the Go for Broke unit, and Al just described how they were go for broke. They were given the tough jobs. They were Japanese Americans, many of whom had families in internment camps. Their families were being held hostage, basically, by the American government at the very time they were risking their lives, and in this case, giving their lives to save other Americans. And you talk about wanting to hug them. I'm sure you've had the opportunity to meet some of the soldiers from the 442nd. What is that like for you? And is there anything that needs to be said? Is it a look in your eye, a hug, a pat on the back, or have you had a chance to actually speak to them how much you appreciated them saving your life?
Oh, yes, I sure did. For about 8 years, I've been a volunteer up at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. Well, one day I'm driving the little shuttle around, and this Japanese-American, Lawson Sakai, says, "Are you Al Tortolano?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm Lawson Sakai." He says, "Somebody told me that you were driving." He said, "I'm with the," he says, "I was with the 442nd. "Oh, my God." He says, "Is there any chance we can get together and talk?" I says, "Oh, yeah, yeah." So anyway, we started talking. He said, "You know," he says, "we have another guy that's a patient here that was a 442nd rescuer too." So he took me up to the room and introduced me to this other guy. And that's how I started getting involved with the 442nd.
And what does that do for you when you get a chance to talk to them and thank them? Do you feel like you're just speaking for yourself, or do you feel like you're speaking for all 220 guys who were saved by their brave actions?
Oh, no, I'm speaking for everybody. Yeah, because I know how they felt, not only speaking for those 220, I think I'm speaking for every other soldier that was in combat over there, thinking that, man, if every division had a 442nd, what a great thing that would be. It would have been for everybody. Every time I see one, I don't care if I saw him yesterday and I see him again today, it's like another new beginning. You know, I look at him and say, wow, this is one of the guys that the reason I'm maybe standing here today, you know. Maybe we would have gotten out of it. We never know. But as far as I'm concerned, they were our saviors.
If you want to hear from the rescuer Al ended up becoming great friends with, Lawson Sakai, you can access that original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. It is time for our final break, but when we come back, a prisoner of war whose life may have been saved by his enemy interrogator. Celebrating 250 years of America through the memories of those who truly understand the price of freedom, Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking America's 250th birthday. One of the dozens of ex-prisoners of war we've heard from over the years on this program told us a story unlike any others we've heard, how a small notation made by his Nazi interrogator may have saved his life. As a bombardier with the 44th Bomb Group, Erwin Stovroff saw the required number of missions climb from 25 when he first got overseas all the way to 35. And he made it to 35 takeoffs, but not 35 landings.
First place, we started off, you're right, at 25, and then they raised it to 30. And then after 30, they said, you know, we'll never fly more than 35. And they were certainly right in my case. They said, because, you know, if we do get the crews in, we were still losing a lot of crews, you know. You will not have to go to the 35th mission. Well, we did. The 35th mission, which was our last, really and truly was our last, because I got shot down. We were just over the channel on a short run. I could see the English Channel right out of my window, and we started our bomb run, and we were going to bomb and blowing up all the bridges to keep the Germans from escaping back into Germany. That was our target that day in the Falaise Gap. and it was near the city of Caen. What happened is there was several bursts of flak, and we got hit on our number one and number two engine, and the hydraulic system failed. Everything was failing. There was fire coming into the ship, so we had to bail out. I was in the nose of the plane, so I jumped through the nose wheel door. And fortunately, every one of us got out of the plane before it exploded. I got rid of my dog tags because I'm Jewish, and it had H on there. And, you know, in those days, I don't know what they're doing now, but you had to have an H, C, or a P on your dog tag. So knowing where I was going, I decided the best thing I could do was get rid of my dog tags because they were shooting at me as I was coming down, so there was no way they would say I was a spy that they had picked up in the country. And I did land right in the German front lines, and I was captured. Well, they were shooting at me coming down. I was captured immediately and taken to a cemetery. And I looked around, and the German officer said, 9-9, we do not kill our prisoners. You know, they kept us in a farmyard for a while. My co-pilot and I tried to escape. We got caught and told us if we'd ever did it again, that they would kill us. They would shoot us for trying to escape, which we were told we were supposed to do, so we tried it one time, and that was that. And after several days in the field, because we couldn't move because our P-51s and P-38s were shooting up everything on the ground, they finally load us in trucks at night, and we ended up in Paris for a few days. And from Paris, I was taken to a Dulag Luft outside of Frankfurt, Germany, where all the air guy, anybody in the Air Force was taken there for interrogation.
And this place is infamous for the interrogations that took place there, and really, in some cases, what some people would call torture. I mean, these prisoners were not necessarily treated pristinely there at Dulag Luft.
Well, all I heard was the scare tactics. You know, they were, you'd hear the noise and the beating and all this stuff, and you'd think, oh my God, what's going to happen now? And I after my original capture and what I went through in the beginning, I was not anything happened to me except an unbelievable story while I was there. I was in solitaire like the rest of us, and you were taken in and out and taken in and out. I think after my fourth interrogation, where it was name, rank, and serial number, because actually we didn't know much more than that, the officer opened up in perfect English and said to me, Lieutenant, you know, I know who you are, and I know what you are. And when he said that, I said, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
And that meant that he knew you were Jewish.
That's right. And so he started off by naming my mother, father, brother, sister, the grammar school I went to, the high school I went to, actually named a young lady that I had taken out when I was dating before the war. And I just sat there and I said, I just don't understand. I don't understand. And then he said to me, well, let me explain something to you. You lived on Claremont Avenue in Buffalo, New York, and my parents lived on Ashland Avenue in Buffalo, New York, and you were my parents' newspaper boy.
Holy moly.
And I said, that's about the same thing. I just couldn't believe it. And he said to me, I came here for a reason. I came to be with my grandparents because we are going to win the war. And that was his answer to me. But he said, I will help you. And what he did do, under religion, on my papers that I found and I still have, he put a question mark under religion. And so I was moved on and put in the boxcars and moved on to my permanent camp in Barth, Germany.
Now, I do have one question about that. My understanding, and I've seen several POWs show me those papers that you're talking about. You have an image of yours online. It was your file from Dulag Luft when you were interrogated. It has your mugshot and all that and all this information. Now, were you sure at the time that he wrote that question mark in there? Or
no.
Did you not find that out until after you were liberated?
After we got liberated, we went into the offices there. And they said, somebody said they found our files, and we all went and we all got our files. And I got mine, and down below, it has a great big J-U-D-E when they segregated me in my prison camp.
What's going through your mind as you get to this prisoner of war camp? Obviously, you have guys around you who are going through the same thing, and I'm sure that helps. But to me, the uncertainty of it seems like it might be a little overwhelming.
Well, you're right, the uncertainty, but there was you had a sense of, at least I made it to a prison camp, you know, because if the civilians got you, they would kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was fortunate. I dropped out in France, but in Germany, a lot of the guys dropped there, and they were pitchforked. They were hung. The German civilians were after them, and the Luftwaffe would try to get you, and at least get you to a prison camp. And it was a relief to, you know, to walk into the camp, and there you are. There's already 1,000 guys or more in the camp, and it's a sense of relief, but a sense of uncertainty, and uncertainty later on in February when I got segregated.
Up to that point, I'm trying to do the math here, from August of 44 until April or May of 45, this is several months that you were a prisoner of war. I imagine that it started to take a toll on you physically as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, and you probably have heard it before, and I tell it just the way it is, we were one of the lucky camps that was getting Red Cross parcels, because if we relied on the Germans, the bread had nothing but sticks in it, and the soup was terrible, and kohlrabis and some lousy potatoes is what they gave us.
So you weren't a fan of tree flour?
Not really. Not really at all. But the Red Cross was able to, I would like to say, regularly. And the truth is, they regularly did get the boxes to us, but the Germans kept them from us because they just did. And we found out after the war was over, in the warehouse, there were stacks of Red Cross boxes that they had kept from us, and I don't know how many they kept for themselves because, you know, we had Spam in there, we had cigarettes in there, we had Klim, which is milk spelt backwards, powdered milk. There was enough there to sustain us. But without that, we all started to lose weight, and we did lose weight, and we did have sicknesses. They only did what they had to do. Would I say they were an enemy that had full respect? Not particularly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've mentioned a couple times being segregated. By early 1945, word started making its way around the camp that the Jewish prisoners would be separated out. And I can't imagine, Erwin, that the first time you heard that, it was anything close to good news.
I really and truly couldn't believe it. My co-pilot's brother was an adjutant to Colonel Gabreski in one of the other compounds. And, of course, they got the news first. And he got a hold of his younger brother, who was my co-pilot, and told him, you know, Get Erwin prepared. We're very concerned. And it was at we were standing at a roll call, and then they said, we want all the Jewish prisoners to remain, and nobody moved. Nobody moved. And then when they started it, our commanding officer, Colonel Zemke,
Hub Zemke, the great P-47 ace.
The great guy. And he was a great, great man. And he really and truly laid it out to the German commandant that you would better understand you're going to lose this war. And you do anything to my men, anything at all to my men, and you will become a war criminal, and I personally will come here and be sure that you are shot. I mean, he did it. He just told him. We had another guy by the name of Colonel Spicer, who really made a tremendous speech, and he was sentenced to death for his speech. But, I mean, I have witnessed and I have lived and I've been in a camp with two of the bravest men I've ever known in my life. Mm. But they did it. They did. They segregated us. We were put in a barracks near the front gate. Every Jewish prisoner that they could find, they put in the same area. And I will tell you, from that moment on, I really and truly was concerned about whether I was going to get home. Up until then, I always felt, I really and truly believed that that the Germans, we knew they were going to lose the war. We knew that when we started, but I had that feeling that I was going to get home. I was absolutely going to get home. Until I got segregated, and then I had questions, and then it was, It was a mental battle then as to what was going to happen.
Now, did you hear at that point that Hitler had ordered all Jewish prisoners to be killed? Is that something?
That's what we were told. And I must honestly tell you, it wasn't a comfortable environment because, you know, as Colonel Zemke said, these men are American officers. We know them as American officers, and they are recognized as American officers, and you are making a segregation of these men? We do not believe in that. That is not the way we do things. Well, you know, I was part of an organization. My plane, there was 10 guys in my plane. Two of us were Jewish, and 8 of us weren't. But, we were all together, and anybody that knows and anybody that lived through flying in one of those planes, you were a team. In combat, you weren't lieutenant, you weren't sergeant, you were whatever your nickname is. My nickname was Russian, and because of my last name being Stovroff, and after we got shot down, I told everybody, for God's sake, don't call me by my nickname. I said, you know, they hate the Russians more than they hate us. And the beautiful part of the whole ending was, I got liberated by the Russians.
What did that feel like when you realized they don't have time to kill us? Their time is up, we're free, and for us, the war is over.
Oh, it's something you really and truly, you know, you cannot live in the past, but you cannot forget it.
And Erwin Stovroff did everything in his power to make sure people would not forget the price of freedom, the true cost of that independence we celebrate on this 250th Independence Day. In his later years, Erwin founded an organization called Vets Helping Heroes, which provides service dogs for disabled veterans. We're out of time for this week, but thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that on America's 250th birthday and every day, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.